panel today is to my right, Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have four cases set for oral argument this afternoon. Before we begin, I would like to mention that we have lost a colleague, Bruce Fife, who was loved and respected by his colleagues, and we will all miss him. All right. If you will call the first case, please.
The court will now call Carter versus Flowers. May it please the court, Mr. Timothy George to argue for appellant, and Ms. Violet McCoye to argue for appellee.
Ready?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Scott Self, on behalf of the appellant, Frankie P. Carter and TMC Auto Transport. We're here today, Your Honors, on a case involving a very simple and relatively undisputed set of facts. Quite simply, my client was hired pursuant to an oral agreement to haul a car for the plaintiff, Mr. Flowers. Mr. Flowers is in the business of used auto sales out in the Hobbs, New Mexico area. And Mr. Flowers purchased a Lincoln Town Car, a used car, from one of the auto auctions here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He entered into an oral agreement with my clients to haul that vehicle from the auto auction to Mr. Flowers' place of business in New Mexico. The evidence, Your Honor, in the record is that that was an oral agreement. There's no evidence of a written agreement. And the oral agreement was very simple, and that was simply to haul the vehicle from point A to point B. And that is the agreement that Your Honors have before you, and that is in the trial record. Subsequent to that agreement, my client's employee did, in fact, pick up the vehicle from the auto auction in the Irving area. And in the course of transporting it to a different auto auction site where he was to pick up other vehicles and take them to New Mexico, he was stopped at a red light in Grand Prairie, where he was violently rear-ended by a drunk driver, a gentleman named Oscar Calderon. And Your Honors have in front of you in the trial record the evidence of the police report from the Grand Prairie Police Department, as well as the testimony of Officer Nicholson, the investigating officer. And key in that evidence is the fact that Officer Nicholson found that the accident and the damage to the vehicles was caused solely by the negligence and gross negligence of the drunk driver, Oscar Calderon. Subsequent to that accident, Your Honors, the evidence in the trial record shows that my client turned over the damaged Lincoln Town Car, and in fact totaled Lincoln Town Car, to a wrecker yard in that area where it was to be determined on how the issue would be handled. We subsequently learned that Mr. Calderon, although he apparently showed evidence of insurance to the Grand Prairie police officers at the scene, in fact did not have effective liability insurance and therefore did not have wherewithal or means to compensate Mr. Flowers for the damage that Mr. Calderon, by his drunken driving, had caused to the vehicle. And we now find ourselves in the present suit. As a result of Mr. Calderon's inability to pay, Mr. Flowers then sued my clients, Carter and TMC Auto Transport, under alternate theories, I should say, of breach of contract and conversion. And plaintiff, Mr. Flowers, has also alleged a theory of bailment. Now, for the purposes of argument and appeal, Your Honors, we do not dispute the facts or their ability to prove a bailment. This does, in fact, appear to be a bailment under the bailment law of Texas. And, in fact, it appears to be what we refer to as a bailment for mutual benefit. It was done for a business purpose. The question, Your Honors, becomes, having established the bailment, what is the standard which plaintiff and appellee in this case has to prove in order to maintain a verdict that is legally sufficient under our breach of contract law as it applies to bailments? In this case, Your Honors, as you can tell from our appeal, we argue that the evidence is legally insufficient to support Judge Sprinkle's finding at bench trial that there was a breach of the bailment contract.
But how can you say that when you took possession of the vehicle and it was never delivered to Mr. Flowers in any condition?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I would simply say that I think implicit in your question is the idea, and this seems to be part of plaintiff's theory, part of appellee's theory, and part of Judge Sprinkle's finding, is that bailment implies a strict liability type of situation, where if the bailee is not able to return the property, in this case the car, in the same condition in which it was delivered.
No, we're not talking about the same condition. We're talking about returning it at all.
Well, Your Honor, then that raises a different question, and one that's also the subject of our appeal, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the question I would say there is then what would be the amount of damages? Because we know in this case, and in fact, Judge Sprinkle did acknowledge in some of our post-trial briefing in a letter that he issued that the damage to the vehicle was caused by the third-party tortfeasor, Mr. Calderon. And in other words, we're talking about the damage of the vehicle prior to the accident, the value of the vehicle prior to the accident. The evidence that the court received on that issue that's in our trial record is that Mr. Flowers had paid approximately $10,000 at auction, the fair market value prior to the accident. The fair market value of the vehicle after the accident, and the evidence is in the trial record to support that, is what was paid for salvage at the wrecker yard. That amount is $1,575. And so, Your Honor, I would say that if the court's question has to do with the bailment as far as not returning the wreck, the salvage value of whatever that car may be, then we're talking apples and oranges as far as values, because Judge Sprinkle's verdict was for a $10,000 actual damage that was for the pre-accident fair market value of the vehicle, whereas it seems to me, Your Honor, your question is more attuned to if there was a failure to return the wreckage or the salvage value, then that should have only warranted a verdict value of at most the $1,575 that the evidence in the trial record shows to have been the post-accident fair market value of the vehicle.
If I give you my car, I entrust my car to you, and it's a $10,000 car, you're saying I don't have a right to get either $10,000, my $10,000 car back, or $10,000, or the difference between the value of the car and as well as the car? You're saying that you can return whatever you want to me?
No, Your Honor, I would ask, in follow-up to your question, would be, are we talking about if there is a reduction in value during the course of the bailment? I think that the question that the law requires us to ask is, was the reduction in value, in this case, very clearly it's property damage or destruction, was that caused by the bailee or was it caused by a third-party tortfeasor? And, Your Honor, the reason I pose that question is we know from the bailment law in Texas, including the authority that we've cited in our briefing, which is the same authority that we cited for Judge Sprinkle in our post-trial briefing when he asks for a little more.
Excuse me. You're saying you get to choose whether you return the car in whatever condition.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that in this case, the evidence is very clear. In fact, it's undisputed. My clients had no choice in what condition the car could have been returned to
but
Mr. Flowers.
They didn't return it at all.
That is correct, Your Honor. They did not return the vehicle. They instead turned it over to a wrecker service so that the insurance companies that were involved could try to make their post-accident adjustment of the situation. And the reason I bring up the causation, Your Honor, is because, as I was saying, the case law that we've cited for bailment in Texas and specifically for this kind of case goes to show that bailment is not a strict liability theory of law in Texas. It is not the law in Texas that if I turn over property to someone and while they have bailment of the property, it is somehow destroyed or lost, that it is automatically the bailee's fault. Rather, as the case law shows, bailment merely creates a rebuttable presumption of negligence on the part of the bailee. And that's a rebuttable presumption that, frankly, disappears once the case goes to a fact finder, in this case, like Judge Sprinkle, because we were at bench trial. And what is undisputed in this case is that not only is the evidence, not only was there no evidence of any negligence whatsoever on the part of my client as the bailee, in fact, the evidence conclusively showed that the damage to the vehicle was caused entirely by the negligence of this third-party tortfeasor. And that, Your Honor, I think you've hit on one of the key issues. And if I could, Your Honor, I would cite specifically to the cases that we cite on page 13 of our brief There's the Tyler Court of Appeals case, Frederick versus Nichols, and perhaps more importantly, the Supreme Court case from 2004, FFE Transportation Services versus Fulgham, where, and I'm quoting the Supreme Court here, we have declined to apply strict liability where there has been a bailment for mutual benefit when the bailment was for the sole purpose of accomplishing the bailor's business purposes. And so, Your Honor, I would submit it's not simply strict liability. The court and the law implores us to undertake an analysis of causation of the damage to the property and to determine who was responsible for that damage.
Well, I think Justice Walker asked you about the failure to return the vehicle at all.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is that your question? Not about who's responsible, not about whether it's strict liability, not about negligence, but about returning the vehicle at all.
That's right, Your Honor. And as I said,
I'm interested in hearing an answer to her question.
It was not returned. It was not returned. The evidence in the record shows that upon instructions from one of the insurance companies involved, that my client turned the vehicle over to one of the wrecker yards that I believe was working in coordination with the Grand Prairie Police Department for the vehicle to be held for the various insurers that were involved, that it would include Mr. Flowers' insurer, my client's insurer, and the drunk driver, Mr. Calderon's insurer, to be able to go and make an analysis of investigation of the wreckage. And then as these companies do their business, to then, I guess, determine amongst themselves who was responsible. During that time, and apparently during the period in which people determined or it was determined that Mr. Calderon did not have effective insurance, during that same time, the trial record shows that the wrecker service, in fact, sold the vehicle itself and collected the $1,500 in salvage value to satisfy its own storage costs. And so the record is actually very clear, Your Honor, that the salvage value, this $1,500 figure that's in the record, that did not inure to the benefit of my client or its insurer.
So did you have UM, UIM?
Not on this type of a policy, Judge, because it was a commercial auto policy, or more like a general liability policy, and not along the lines of a personal auto policy or one that might typically have that type of coverage.
So you don't think that was a duty that you had to the person that gave you the car in case an accident happened?
Judge, I'll be frank, I'm not a coverage lawyer, so I don't know offhand what the duties of a auto hauler like my client are as far as insurance, but I'm not aware of that type of a duty, and I know that plaintiff has never alleged that my client had that type of duty.
Do you agree that you owe them the value of the salvage?
Your Honor, I would agree under a theory of conversion that seems to me be a more appropriate way to attack that issue.
Well, you just told me a minute ago. Didn't deliver the car.
That's correct.
So if you didn't deliver the car, you need to deliver the salvage value of the car in lieu of the car.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure about, because we also pled the defense of impossibility to the breach of contract theory. Impossibility to, first of all, to be able to deliver the car in its whole and undisturbed condition.
Okay, what if it was damaged to the extent of $5,000? Are you going to tell me I've got to deliver it in its whole and undisturbed condition?
And I'm sorry, I'm not
delivered to him at all?
No, sir, but I think in this situation, the question you seem to be asking me is, did my client have a duty to deliver to the man either the salvage or the value of the salvage?
Correct.
And that's why I raised the point that my client never took that, received such money, or itself was paid any that type of money.
Did the owner of the car authorize you to turn it over to the salvage?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that, and it's not in the trial record, Your Honor, that there was ever any communications with them between Mr. Flowers and my client's employee or my client about what to do with the wreckage.
I can't possibly see how you take the position if some third party has no ownership interest in the car, tells you to do something with the car, you do it, it's then sold for a fourth party's interest to salvage, and you take the position, I didn't even give them the car in a wrecked condition or the money that was obtained from the salvage.
Well, Your Honor, the position is, Your Honor, the fact that my client didn't go sell that wreckage, in fact, that was done without my client's consent, that it was sold by this wrecker yard.
Your consent to turn it over to the salvage yard at the instructions of a third party that had no interest in the car?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's fairly common when we have accidents where vehicles are totaled. In this situation, where the vehicle is turned over to a, whether a wrecker yard, a storage yard.
I don't think it's the law. We're not worried about what's common. Well, we want to work about something common. Let's worry about common sense. Common sense tells me you've got to deliver in the car or deliver in the salvage value of the car, and then we'll worry about the difference later. And you're taking the position we don't owe him anything.
Well, Your Honor,
I have a position to take it. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you know, that's not entirely the position. The trial record, I believe, reflects, Your Honor, that we had made an offer of settlement, a formal offer of settlement prior to trial that was in excess and more than reasonably in excess of the salvage value we're talking about. It's just the difference between $10,000 paid for the vehicle, the $13,500 that they claimed all along for the vehicle versus $1,575 in salvage value. So I can tell you and represent in good faith, Your Honor, that certainly there were conversations in which there were attempts made to take care of the thing for more than salvage value, but that's not been the pursuit of plaintiff and the appellee in this case. It's been the full market value of the vehicle as well as full attorney's fees under a breach of contract theory. And if I may, Your Honor, I know that I'm running short on time. I would just simply note that our appeal is based on three grounds. One is the legal sufficiency of the breach of contract finding that Judge Sprinkle made. Two is the legal sufficiency of the damages awarded by Judge Sprinkle under the breach of contract theory. And three is the legal sufficiency of the attorney's fees award under Judge Sprinkle's findings on a number of bases.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
If you may please the court. My name is Violet Nokoye, and I represent Mike Flowers. I was also the trial attorney at the trial court level. You know, we're here today based on the appeal on four issues that they have presented, but I'm just going to go into the bailment contract since some of the issues were not addressed. This is uncontested that this was a bailment contract, a mutual bailment contract, and that the defendant owed my client a duty to exercise reasonable care in preserving and also hauling his property.
How did he not carry that out?
He did not carry it out by returning the vehicle to my client, and while the vehicle was in his possession, it was sold without his authority. He did not authorize him to sell his property.
Okay, that goes to damage. I'm hearing it. It's back up to duty of reasonable care.
Okay.
How is reasonable care not used if we assume that a drunk driver, due to no fault of the transporters, of course, they're not a drunk driver, hit the vehicle and damaged where in there is a lack of reasonable care?
You know, we have never claimed that the defendant did not was a cause of the accident.
Right.
That's not our case. Our case is that after the accident, what did they do with the vehicle? They did not deliver the vehicle. They did not take care of the vehicle. At trial, the defendant testified that he did not know where this vehicle was. When asked, where is the vehicle? He said he gave it to the insurance company. And when asked, did you inquire from the insurance company about the whereabout of this vehicle? He said no. So he basically dropped. He was asked by his insurance company to tow the vehicle or haul the vehicle to an auto shop and then left the vehicle there and never went back, never asked about whatever happened to this vehicle. So at that point, we believe that the trial court was correct when they found that they did not fully exercise that duty of reasonable care.
How would the damages be $10,000 to the car if we assume Texas is not a strict liability state in connection with failed contract?
Yes, Your Honor, I can answer that. At trial, we did present evidence that the market value for this vehicle was $13,150. That was admitted into evidence and is on record with the court today. And at that point, that was what, at the point of delivery to the defendant, that was what the car was worth. We were not awarded $13,150. We were awarded $10,000. My client had no opportunity to reevaluate the value of his vehicle. He was not given the opportunity to do that. The defendant wanted my client to go off their own evaluation that his car was worth $1,500. And that is, I believe, a fact that the court had to decide without any evidence to show. They showed no pictures of this vehicle. They showed nothing other than that it was sold for $1,500 as the value of the vehicle after the wreck. And we do not accept that, Your Honor. So based on that, I believe that the trial court properly applied the measure of damages when it comes to bailment contract, which is the market value at the time of delivery minus the value at the time of the breach. And basically, we have no value. We have zero, which would have made our award up to $13,150. But the court, however, awarded $10,000.
So basically what you're saying is that at the time of the auction, the value was established at $10,000, and then after the incident, it was incumbent on them as they wanted to place a different value on it as a result of the wreck, and your position is they didn't prove that.
They did not prove the value, Your Honor. They gave us no opportunity to actually prove the value. As far as we were concerned, the value after the breach is zero because my client did not get a dime from the sale, and which leaves the value at $13,000 if the court actually went strictly by the rule on applying damages to bailment property. We understand that, Your Honor. They did based on their evaluation on the sale of the, but they actually did not provide the, they had the opportunity to provide to the court the condition of this vehicle after the wreck by pictures or any expert evaluation of this wreck. We did not get the opportunity to do all that because my client's property was completely gone. And even after we demanded to return the vehicle in the position, in any condition it was in, they could not because they already sold the vehicle without consent, Your Honor. And then on the defense of impossibility, which the defendant posed, the appellant poses here, it was possible for them to transport this vehicle from the scene of the accident to the Dallas Auto auction. That wasn't a problem. And I don't see how, if they could, this vehicle was still able to be hauled by the defendants, I don't see why they could not haul the vehicle to my client, even in its present condition. If they had hauled this vehicle, even if it was damaged, we would be here for a different issue, Your Honor. Right now, we don't have the vehicle, and they claim they were not able to haul this vehicle. The defense of impossibility is not for them not to do anything just because it's more difficult or it's going to cost a little more to perform their contract. There's no, this defense of impossibility here, Your Honor, does not apply to the situation that we have. And you know, if I may state, the issue of damages, the way the damages was awarded was not even presented on the brief. I noticed that it was addressed on the reply brief to my brief, but on the appellant brief, that wasn't one of the issues that was presented to this court. Okay. At this point, yes. Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Briefly.
So, whose burden is it, if according to you, to prove the value of the vehicle after the wreck?
Your Honor, if the proper measure of recovery under her theory of recovery is post-accident damages, then I think that burden remains with the appellee. As the burden of proof on all damages that are properly recoverable.
Well, if you turned it over to the salvage yard and the salvage yard turned around and sold it, how were they supposed to do that?
Well, I agree, Your Honor, that would make that process difficult. I would also note, though,
be stopped from taking that position.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that earlier I thought I understood you to say that there was not evidence of the post-accident value of the vehicle, but there is, Your Honor. Defendant's Exhibit 2, which was properly admitted as part of the court's record, is the invoice from Syntex Claim Company salvage report, which reflects the bidding process for the wreckage, and that it actually reflects 10 different bids that came in, the highest of which was $1,575. So, Your Honor, that is, I think, legitimate evidence of the post-accident value of the wreckage. Not only what someone actually paid in an arm's-length transaction, but that it was done in a bidding process would even, I think, more legitimize that value. And so I think Your Honor does have in front of you post-accident value for the vehicle. And that, Your Honor, seems to be the inconsistency in the argument that you just heard. On the one hand, appellee's counsel said that I've only ever been complaining about not turning over the wreckage to me after the accident, but then tells you that they've been seeking full fair market value of the vehicle prior to the accident. And there are two numbers that you heard there. You heard that they had pled and disclosed this amount of approximately $13,500 that they use Mr. Flowers as a person certainly with knowledge of retail value of vehicles, of what it might go for. But the $10,000 number actually came on a question directly from Judge Sprinkle when Judge Sprinkle asked Mr. Flowers, what did you just pay for the vehicle in the moments or hours before this accident? And that's where the $10,000 came from. Your Honor, as a last rebuttal issue, I would note that we did challenge the legal sufficiency of the attorney's fees award in this case. That has to do with the law under Chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. The appellee is seeking recovery of attorney's fees under 38001, having to do with pleading damages under a written contract. Of course, I know Your Honors know that Section 38002 requires a written presentation of those damages and notice letter in order to make recovery of those. And there's been no evidence of any such presentation in this case. In fact, the trial record reflects that at trial, when Ms. Nicoye is counsel for the appellee, went under oath to prove up her damages, that I did question her and ask her to please provide us with evidence of a notice letter. I asked her to provide us with evidence that there'd ever been disclosure under Rule 194.2D of the attorney's fees or method of calculating, Ms. Nicoye was unable to provide any documentation and certainly did not submit any evidence to support presentment or disclosure of those damages. Yes.
Are you waiving your issue on the deemed admission?
I am, Your Honor, and I'll be very candid and tell you that was an issue where my appellate colleague who took this matter up and working from the trial record noticed that hadn't been formally dealt with in Judge Sprinkle's court. And in discussing it with him, and then after his discussions with Ms. Nicoye, I did tell him that because of some peculiar circumstances that quite frankly had to do with a medical condition involving Ms. Flowers' wife, that in Judge Sprinkle's court I did withdraw my argument based on the deemed admissions and said that I thought our case was strong enough on its merits that we didn't need to deal with procedural issues like that.
I have a question about your when you did your initial presentation, you said that the case involved three issues, and one of them was the legal and factual sufficiency of the evidence to support the $10,000 damages award.
That's right.
And appellee's counsel has indicated that was not raised as an issue in your brief, but only in the reply brief, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that I would I would describe or characterize the mention in the reply brief as more of a clarification. Clearly, in the appellate brief, we say that we are challenging the legal sufficiency of the findings under the theory of breach of bailment contract. And the record that we've provided the court with, I believe, also includes our post-trial briefing that Judge Sprinkle had requested of the parties between the time of the bench trial and the time that he actually entered judgment in April of this year. And that likewise challenged the legal sufficiency of the court's finding on breach of bailment contract, both from a sufficiency on a liability finding and on a sufficiency of the evidence to support the award. So we believe we did raise that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business, or you may stay and watch other people argue.
Thank you.